My name is Willie Bolander. I study influence, persuasion, and leadership in selling and sales management, and I teach people how to sell. In this podcast, we'll talk to some of the world's top sales leaders and see what we can learn from them. Welcome to the Sales Lab. So the purpose of this conversation is really to explore the topic of what is technical sales at Johnson Controls. And you know, the fact that we've not talked before, to me, I think is actually a good thing. Sometimes people ask for like a question list, or we'll do a little pregame, and the conversation becomes very stiff.
I'm very off the cuff. That's my whole people. All the leaders that work for me make fun of me a lot because I'm like, just go in, you know. What is it? Aim, shoot, aim, fire, or fire, yeah. Whatever it is. You know what I'm saying? So, I've been with our company long enough that, and I started off in technical sales, was an industrial distribution graduate, and all that good stuff, which is pretty cool. So when they mentioned it to me, I was like, man, I'd love to do this. That'd be great.
This content is brought to you by the TIE Sales Showdown. That's the Technical, Industrial, and Engineering Student Sales Showdown, hosted right here at Texas A&M University. We have over 200 engineering students taking sales classes every semester and a growing minor program in technical sales. These students are smart enough for STEM and savvy enough for sales, and the TIE Showdown allows them to demonstrate their selling skills in a role-play competition where industry partners, like you, serve as judges and provide them coaching feedback. If you're hiring for technical, industrial, or engineering sales roles anytime in the next couple of years, this is an event you can't miss. You can learn more at tx.ag/ties. That's tx.ag/TIES. Hope you can join us.
That's awesome.
Well, then let's start there. Why don't you tell us where you came from, a little bit about your path to where you are now?
Yeah, sure. So I graduated from Texas A&M, started in civil engineering, believe it or not. Okay. And my dad's a mining engineer, like lignite coal mine, but surface level, not big tunnels in the ground. And so I, like, growing up, I knew I was going to do engineering, started off in civil, it was fine. I enjoyed it. It was just kind of this immediate, like, wait a second, do I want to sit behind a desk all day? Right now, 18 years later, I may still be sitting behind a desk all day, but for a lot of years doing technical sales, I was not. And so I kind of started to explore my options, and I actually thought about doing mechanical engineering, but kind of saw that a little bit of the same, and then ended up in industrial distribution because I saw it had a really good mix of still maintaining and challenging and growing the technical aptitude, but also being able to go in a lot of different career paths that would allow me to have more flexibility on what I would want to do when I graduated from college. So class of 2006 from Texas A&M, industrial distribution, started with Johnson Controls. June 4th was 18 years ago, right? Wow. Out of A&M. So was hired on as a technical sales engineer, and was responsible for selling all of our HVAC equipment and building automation system products and systems. Having the technical background helped a lot because we spent the first 3 to 6 months back and forth between here and Milwaukee, where it was more technical training really on what I was going to be selling, but also sales training at the same time. So a lot of the stuff that I learned when I was in Norm's sales classes very quickly became applicable and were quite helpful, actually, to just
got his book right here.
A good starting place, and feel a lot more comfortable right out of the gate. Right. So I did just real quick. I did that for 8 years. I was a technical sales manager or technical sales, then moved into the sales leadership position in Houston. And I did that for 4 years, and then moved into the leadership sales leadership role over Texas, still responsible for HVAC equipment and controls, but for all of Texas.
Perfect.
And then about 2 years ago, moved into the role that I'm in now as the market general manager for Greater Houston. So that is down to Galveston, halfway to San Antonio, including College Station, kind of over to Huntsville, all the way over to Beaumont and back around. So okay. We have really proud. We have a great team, great business. We have like we have 500 employees in Houston.
Oh, wow.
Across our HVAC equipment, smart building controls, fire alarm, and security businesses. And so, yeah, it's a lot to keep the arms wrapped around, but and a lot of customers. But the technical, once you have the technical sales side in you, you can't ever get rid of it, right? So people bring me problems and I need them to go solve them, but I still enjoy the technical so much that I start asking questions on stuff that I was in the weeds on 15 years ago, right? Because it's just naturally you love the technical side of things and understanding how things work and while if they're not work, what's broken, what needs to be corrected. And so, yeah, it's been a long journey, but it's been quite rewarding. I laugh thinking about how different my career would look if I had never ventured into industrial distribution and really opened my horizon on what the options were and what was out there. Cause I would have never, as an engineer focus and mindset, I would have never even realized that technical sales was a thing. And it's a massive, massive industry with the need for a lot of really, you know, strong and developed talent.
For sure. And I'm hearing you say sort of HVAC and building automation. Now, these are two things that don't necessarily hold hands together in my head, right? It's not obvious to me that those would be lumped together. Why? Why are those two in the same kind of division?
Because you actually cannot do one without the other. So when you think about a building on Texas A&M's campus, whether you think about a hospital, you think about a high-rise building in downtown Houston, you think about a school, you know, fill in the blank, a church, whatever it may be. When people think of HVAC, they think of a 510 split system that's ran off a thermostat in their home, right?
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is instead of a 5-ton system, we're talking about somewhere like Texas A&M that has 100,000 tons of cooling that serves buildings. And then that chilled water goes into air handling units. And you have to have something to control the amount of water that's going through those coils. And you have to have something that controls the speed of the fan to regulate the temperature and the airflow going out of that unit. And then all of that's being fed and controlled based on the space temperature set points, right? So without building automation and, you know, building management control system, which you'll hear BAS, BMCS, all the different terms, you don't have the ability to be able to control the HVAC equipment that would be in a commercial application. Like hard stop, right? Now, so that's changed a lot now. That was originally temperature control, building automation, right? But now we're controlling lights, we're controlling window shades. We're going well beyond what is just controlling HVAC to tracking occupants in a space and understanding occupant traffic and how a end user could change how that they need to set up their facility based on occupancy traffic. And I mean, that's just one of tons of things. And then with digitalization and continued growth around sustainability, obviously energy spend and carbon footprint is a massive priority. And so that's where you get into what you and I talked about right before we kicked this off was just like the ROI and understanding, okay, yes, we can put in this central plant optimization truly where it's learning and adjusting in real time with algorithms. And it's going to cost $500,000, but you're going to save $250,000 a year because of the energy savings. So it's a 2-year ROI, right? And so it's gotten far more sophisticated and technology is changing so rapidly. But it's really cool working for somebody like Johnson Controls because we just consistently stay on the cutting edge of taking the voice of the customer and the industry to drive technology changes.
Well, and I guess that
gives you good footing to, you know, come at it from a new value proposition pretty frequently, right? Okay, maybe we didn't get a deal because they didn't like the thing we had that we were focused on a couple years ago. That wasn't enough for them. But now we've got some new functionality, some new value that we can kind of show up and talk about.
I'll share one quick example. I was just at lunch with a customer and we were meeting with a customer. I was meeting with the customer to kind of talk through some things around a follow-up meeting that was going to take place with a very high profile, well-known customer in Houston. And one of the things that at the lunch, the customer asked me was like, hey, well, can you point to where you've done this in the last 5 years? And I said, barely. And he says, why? And I said, because technology has been changing so rapidly that what we would have sat down and talked to a customer about 5 years ago when they were building, you know, a multi-billion dollar project is completely different technology than what we're talking about now. Right. Yeah. And so understanding all of that and being able to have the conversation of like, hey, there's a right way and a wrong way to do this. And like I said, mixing the technology and the sales together is allowing a customer to realize that, hey, by the time your building or your stadium or your campus is done, your technology could already be 3 and 4 and 5 years old because it was designed and procured 5 years ago, right? And so along the same lines of what you described, there's all of those dynamics that are consistently going on that we're having to educate and talk to customers about. And that looks very different depending on what type of customer we're working with.
Okay. And who is it that you're actually calling on? Can you like maybe pick a hypothetical deal and walk us through, you know, how you identify that there's an opportunity, who you reach out to, how many people are in the room and how many different decision makers, just kind of start to finish.
Yeah. So let's say that, and this is not the example, but I'll just use it as an example, but let's just say that, the Rockets in Houston, we're going to build a new arena, right? This is a complex version, but this is just, it's cool to think through because this is what we do every single day in some form or fashion at some level of scalability. Well, if they're going to build a new arena, you have the owner and the end user, right? The financial decisions, and let's say it's the Houston Rockets. Well, in a lot of instances, they have a operating group that runs their facility that may be farmed out and may be contracted out. And that's a completely different group, right? So that group has their priorities. The owner has their priorities. The end user has their priorities. And so when I think about it, legs of the stool, those are two legs of the stool that is really important that we are not only going and spilling our candy and telling them everything we can do, but way more understanding what their goals, their priorities, their grand gesture or vision is for something like that. And then how do we as an organization support that and meld into that, right? Now, interestingly enough, that's only two of about 5-6 legs of the stool. Because when it comes to something getting built like that, we have a general contractor. The general contractor's buying security, and we're full building systems. We're one of the only ones in the entire world that we're all in on buildings as Johnson Controls, and we don't really have other subsidiaries, right? So the general contractor's buying security. The electrical contractor's buying fire alarm. The mechanical contractor is buying HVAC equipment, and then either the mechanical contractor or the general contractor are buying the building automation, right? Now, obviously, the mechanical and electrical work for the general. And so when we're pursuing a large opportunity like that, we're covering all those legs of the stool. And the final and one of the most critical is they're hiring an architect who hires an MEP consultant, mechanical, electrical, and plumbing consultant. And they're ones who are actually designing the new facility. So we're working very closely with that customer too, to educate. We consistently, this isn't just a one time, like these are customers that we fully account manage all the time because they're always doing business. We're building relationships with them. We're trying to add value. We're helping identify problems and bring solutions, right? So we're not cold calling typically on these customers. These are customers we've called on for a long time. But as you think through that, that's a lot of people involved. And so the way that my team is set up is we have technical sellers that are, we're not all things to all people, right? So I have a, because of the subject matter expertise and the criticality of that, I have an HVAC equipment sales team, HVAC controls and smart building sales team, a fire sales team, and a security sales team, right? So that we have the right folks that are calling on all those different types of customers instead of trying to have and build relationships over time and really account manage and build trust and add value instead of having, you know, one seller that's responsible for all the different fields trying to wear a lot of different hats and be all things to all people all the time. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. So less of a quarterback model and more of a, separate teams having to do their own thing.
Well, and yes, but, and then a lot of the time, in almost every instance, it's a big opportunity. We always have a quarterback, right? We always have somebody that's running point to, if you will, herd the cats consistently and keep everybody on the same page and make sure that we're driving the right strategy and action items are getting followed up on and we're influencing in the right areas. And so it's taken time, but when I started 18 years ago, I had a phenomenal sales manager. He still works for the company, still one of my mentors. I learned from him. And then the cool thing is most of the sales managers that sit in this office, at least for HVAC, all worked for me prior. And so we've all had this same culture of how we do things. And it's been fruitful, and obviously new salespeople are coming in all the time and we're growing the team and we're adding to it, but we kind of have a means, method, and madness for everything that we do to kind of put ourselves in the best possible position to win with an end goal of being able to earn the customer's business, build their trust, and have a lifelong customer.
Perfect. How long does it usually take for a deal to start and close and finish?
That's a good question. There's no answer. There's jobs that, like, for instance, right now we are doing a massive job out at United Airlines. They're redoing Terminal B at IAH. Yeah. We've been working on that job for a couple years as it was underway. And then we just booked the contract a couple months ago. And so, and it will execute for the next 2 years, right? There's other jobs that, from a construction perspective, that, you know, it may be a job that we weren't driving or well ahead of, but mechanical contractor, electrical contractor calls us in, it bids a month later, we get the award, we book, and we start executing, right? I do want to make sure a lot of what I've referenced is construction, but we also have an owner direct team. Right. Which is also technical sales. Well, all that they're doing is selling to end users and owners, you know, Texas A&M, Houston Rockets, Heinz, school districts, K-12, you know, any of that, those type of customers where they're selling service, but they're not just selling service. They're selling solutions. Right. And so that business can be, the day-to-day is more transactional as far as maybe it's service calls or preventative maintenance on their equipment or doing inspections on their fire alarm or whatever it might be. But simultaneously, we're working with those customers to build capital plans, to build looking at life cycle of equipment, of system, fire alarm systems, security systems, control systems, and then how are we helping them budget 1, 2, 5, 10 years out as their systems need to be modernized, where we can come in and do those projects as well, because we've earned the trust and credibility from working so closely with them day in and day out.
Gotcha. And now that we know a little bit about what Johnson Controls does, how would you define technical sales?
I think everybody hears sales. I'll start with the sales portion of it. Because I think everybody hears sales and they think used car salesman. I had that stigma coming in. And so I violently worked to not be that, right? And it wasn't it was very quickly that I realized that none of the sales engineers around me were that either. Like, it was just a stigma that I was completely wrong about, right?
Yeah.
And so when you think about technical sales, the sales side of it really comes down to fundamental things. It comes down to being able to identify problems for a customer. If they already know the problems or they don't, bring solutions to the table. Most of those times, those solutions are technical solutions. Fundamentally, like, this is like going to sound so crazy, but the two biggest things to me in sales is doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it, and then being an effective communicator. Like, those two things are so critical. And then the people that are able to do that well, they naturally build trust over time. And inevitably, what you're driving as a sales engineer is you're working to build trust with the customers because they have an option to go somewhere else. And they've got five other people probably trying to come sell them and educate them on the same things we are. So it really comes down to building a brand for yourself of when XYZ consulting engineering firm thinks of Lucas Matika, what's the brand that goes with that? Right?
Yeah.
And so people buy from people they like way more than they buy from a company, right? So the ability to build trust, build credibility, and be reliable are so important. Now, from a technical perspective, when I first started, there was exponentially more that I didn't know than I did know, right? And so I realized my greatest asset, and this is true with anybody, is to figure out who the smartest people are in the room are or in your company are that you can lean on. And so what I was always so intentional to do with customers, if I didn't know the answer, I would tell them I didn't know the answer. And then I would go back to what we just talked about of what makes a good salesperson. And I would work violently to get the answer, the right answer, as fast as possible, and then get back to them and clearly and communicate that in a manner that was both professional and value add. Now, it doesn't happen. It doesn't take very long before you start hearing questions and you've already answered those questions before, right? And so you build proficiency over time. And a really interesting dynamic, depending on the customer that you call on, is you're dealing with customers that in most instances know a tremendous amount, right? So there's no trying to fake it until you make it. But once you're at a place where you technically, the fun part of the job is the technical, right? Because you start talking about, you start getting in the weeds with them on things and you know that they have an opinion. Well, you're never going to tell a consulting engineer sitting in a room, no, you're wrong. This is the right answer, right? So the fun part is you know the right answer. You've built the credibility. You start asking questions. It's like, well, what about this? What if we did this? You almost lead them to water. So you're gleaning, getting them talking and getting them thinking. And then you're working towards an answer that you know you need to get to, right?
Yeah.
You can do that without it being technical sales, but it's a lot more fun with technical sales because there's really a right answer. Right. Scientifically, in a lot of what we do, there's a right answer.
There's an optimal solution to a given problem.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. And it doesn't mean that it's the only solution, but from a technical perspective, you can build a case to show why it's the optimal solution. Right. I think one of the most fun that I ever had as a technical sales engineer was calling on consultants. Right. And help the MEP consultants, the helping mechanical engineers lay out a new central plant that was going to have 20,000 tons of cooling. And we're doing every iteration of chiller selections for those chillers. And the engineer has in their mind what needs to be done. You think there's a better solution. And you work sometimes days, sometimes weeks and months to do iterations to finally get to the place where you either willed them into submission or you've influenced them with credibility to the point that you can get land them on the solution that you're wanting to drive. And I think for me, the last part of that I'll share is there's plenty of times the consultants would come to me. You talk about building trust. I'm like, hey, we have a solution for that, but we're not the right solution. Like, I would love to be able to do this for you, but here's the solution and here's why you should reach out to X, Y, and Z to help with it, because they're going to be the better solution. Okay, I lost an opportunity to help design a job, but I built tremendous credibility because I understood the technical side of things well enough to know not just myself, but our competitors. And then know that I could do all that work and our competitor was going to win it anyway, or I could tell the customer that and build a ton of rapport in the process to where, hey, Luke may not always tell me what I like or want to hear, but I know I can trust what he's going to tell me. Or I go by Luke or Lucas. Sorry. I just third person to myself and I said Luke. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think people can get really in the weeds trying to think of all these abstract ways to build trust and credibility. And you know, it can be real simple. Just follow through. Just make valid recommendations. You know, if you make a recommendation, back it up with compelling evidence. Don't ask them to take your word for it or just go along with you. Right. Demonstrate the validity of your claims. You know, a lot of the same stuff that goes into being a good, you know, arguer or debater or something. Yeah, right. It's exactly like, right. Hey, we're not just throwing things out. But I mean, to me, that's one of the fundamental differences in technical versus non-technical sales is, you know, there's a real burden to demonstrate your claims. You know, it's not enough to slap them on the back and say, oh, you know, come on, let's do it. It'll be fun. It'll be great. You know, there are some consumer, non-technical consumer facing sales contexts where you can still do those sorts of things. And, you know, you do that in a, you know, specialized technical industrial market. Well, you're going to mess up your relationships with what are probably already a relatively small number of potential buyers in the market. And, you know, you only need to mess one or two of those up before you're in some trouble. So,
yeah, I always tell my team, your reputation and your intent walk in the doorway before you do. Right. Mm. And so to what you're saying, it's exactly true. And I think not everybody's made to do technical sales. Right. I think there is a component of, I do think fundamentally you have to be competitive because you are going up against competitors every single day who want to win at all cost. Right. And I want to win at all costs. Now I've always been of the opinion there's a right way to do that and a wrong way to do that from a moral perspective, from an integrity, from a character perspective. But like, part of the fun is the will to win, right? But I do think the second part of that's so critical is like what does differentiate a sales person from a technical sales engineer, however you want to define it, is really that what you get motivated by is the ability to go sell a solution, but be able to create the technical solution or the argument, if you will, or the backup for why it's the right solution, right? And so for me, that was always one of the most fun parts of the job.
Sure. And you're mentioning competitiveness, so that's a good segue for me to ask about, you know, the other competencies. What are the things that somebody brings to the table that will help them be exceptionally good in technical sales?
We've talked about it a little bit, but like, when I have a new hire come in, like here's some of the things I'll just rapid fire to you that I would tell every one of them is, and this is just maybe more advice in general coming out of school. is that especially if you're doing technical sales or anything along those lines where you're customer facing, you're never going to walk into a room where you're not the youngest person for multiple years, right? And so as odd as it sounds, like I'm casual, I'm in a polo today, but I don't go see customers like this, right? Even when now I'm 41 now, even when I was young, I for sure didn't. Because I always had the mentality that when I walk in the door as a young sales engineer, they're likely not going to take me seriously, right? And the worst thing that I could ever do is demonstrate by my appearance that I don't take myself seriously either. And so I had the mentality that I'm always going to present myself in a manner that is professional and even more professional than a lot of the customers that I know that I was going to see, because in my mind, it helped create a very good first impression. And I know that this is a little off of technical sales, but I think it's important for college grads. Like, I know my own biases that exist when I walk in the room to do an interview with somebody. How are they dressed? How are they presented? Is their hair combed? Is it like all these things that are just natural biases that exist that create an immediate first impression that you have to then battle against sometimes. Well, I have the conviction that I'm going to battle against it. A lot of people don't. And if you walk in and somebody makes that opinion, well, you may never be able to change their mind because they're not really interested in you changing their mind. So I think as simple as it is, how you carry and handle yourself and how seriously, with humility, you take yourself is the good first step for how customers are going to take you who have done this, done whatever it is, a lot longer than you and are a lot more experienced than you. The next thing that I'll say that's critical for being a successful salesperson is the ability to ask good questions and listen. We're so quick. I was actually just having a coaching conversation with one of our sales folks yesterday. And I was telling her we were at lunch with a customer and I was like, hey, you did a really great job. But there were multiple times where you were so eager to say something that was likely important and good to say that you cut off the customer when they were in the middle of telling us some very valuable information. It was even part of the main reason we were sitting in that meeting, right? And so some of the best salespeople I've ever been around, they have the great and uncanny ability to ask really good questions and then just shut up and listen. The two other things, and I'll shut up on this, but ability to qualify is ask the right questions and know the questions that you're asking. Every customer, I hate to say this, but every customer and every opportunity is not worth your time. Mm. You can spend days, weeks, months, and years on an opportunity that never had a stinking chance of getting off the ground.
Yeah.
And salespeople will have happy years. They don't ask the hard questions. Like, do you have the budget for this? What's the compelling event? Who's the final decision maker? Is it you or is it somebody else? What happens if we don't move forward with this product, right? I'm just throwing out a bunch of like the ones over the years that I've used myself and told my team that are hard questions. And sometimes salespeople don't want to know the answers, so they don't ask them. And then they invest all of their time that's going to have zero ROI. And then the last thing we already hit on was, and I think this is more fundamental than everything else because you can be really good at all that other stuff, but if you're not reliable, quick to respond, do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it, all the other stuff doesn't matter. Because somebody else will have all those strengths and they'll be the most reliable sales engineer, and that's who the customer will default to every single time, right?
Yeah.
So that's the sales. The technical part of things is you've got to be passionate about being a lifelong learner and understanding your trade and the technical side of things in a manner where you can sit with confidence over time with your customers and bring value-added solutions to the table and have confidence to know that they're the right solutions. And if you just try to be the sales guy or the sales girl without the competent subject matter expertise on the technical side of things in the background, it doesn't take long until customers see through that. Mm.
You know, as I'm having these conversations with different managers, different sales leaders, what you just described, I'd probably put under the banner of curiosity, is a term that's come up in a lot of these conversations. And that's interesting to me. And it really, you know, I start watching people, you know, on the news or, you know, people who have lots to say and thinking, you know, does this sound like somebody who's curious or just utterly convinced of, you know, like you can start to, you know, play with this a little bit in real time just by observing people, you know, you can tell when somebody's interested, you know, really interested, not interested because the book said I had to act interested, you know?
Well, and so, you hit on something that I just love. So I'm late to the game, but I've been watching, Ted Lasso. And my favorite scene in Ted Lasso is him playing a game of darts. It's a long story, but he's talking about, he quotes Walt Whitman and he says, be curious, not judgmental. And then, and he said, I like that. And then he starts walking through what it looks like to be curious and what it looks like to be judgmental. And interestingly enough, as I watched that scene, I thought about the very same things you just described. We are in a society where very few people are curious. They're definitely not curious to hear other people's opinions that don't agree with theirs. And so it is a unique ability in the generation and the day and age that we live in. But to your point, I do think that in any instance, whether it's a friend, whether it's somebody you met in the coffee shop, or whether it's a customer, people can sense authentic curiosity versus manufactured curiosity, right? And so yeah, it's something that you have to really train yourself to be able to. That's kind of why I hit on humility earlier, is if you think like I'll make fun of myself real quick, is my boss, who's still, like I said, my first boss hired me, still a mentor. I was a year into the role and he said to me, Luke, when your competence catches up with your confidence, you're going to be really dangerous. And I like smiled and got two steps away and I'm like, wait a second. and so while I hit on humility, is I think it's important. Like, it's important to work really hard, but you've earned nothing, right? And the ability to be curious, the ability to have humility, I think naturally creates a curiosity. Because pride and arrogance creates a judgment because you already have all the answers. And I think that it is just magnified where other people can sense that very easily. Whether the person themselves has enough self-awareness to realize it or not, others sense it. And it's usually the people that, like, people are avoiding those sales engineers, and they're avoiding those type of people because it's like, there's it's uncomfortable. There's no good use for them. They're not going to, you know, it's just, the list goes on of the very different dynamic that exists.
Yeah. Well, I think I like the way you just phrased that. You know, it's sort of curiosity requires humility or vulnerability, right? If I'm going to ask you questions, if I'm going to, you know, dig deeper into whatever the problem is or your context, it kind of comes along with the message, at least implied, that I don't have all the answers. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, you're going to have to explain that to me again. Show me what you mean, right? And I sometimes tell our students, you know, there are people in this world who have been told any sign of vulnerability is bad. It's a sign of weakness, you know, hide it at all costs. And I think those people are just really wrong. You know, we're living in a real world. We're trying to deliver real solutions. If you don't know, for the love of God, don't try to press real hard and get me to buy your $5 million thing if it's not going to do what we need it to do. Not good for you in the long run, not good for me in the long run, you know?
When I was early on in my career, and this was also coaching I got from that same manager, was one of the things that I learned, and I shared this yesterday with the same salesperson, is the greatest thing you can do as a young sales engineer is connect with customers that you then create a dynamic with where they feel like they're, your fate of being successful is in their hands, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it takes a very interesting dynamic to where you build rapport, you build trust, you're very humble because you're willing to say you don't know all the answers and you don't have everything figured out, but you're like asking them to help you. Hey, who could you introduce me to over here? How could you? And two of the biggest customer over like takeovers where we went from doing nothing to doing a ton. In both of those instances, it was, I found a top decision maker or owner in the organization, built a rapport with them, and then really asked them to help. What does good look like? Right. And man, they were all in. Yeah. They and then I didn't let them down, right? I like made sure, man, they're going to put their neck out for me to help. I better never let them down and make them look stupid, like a regret the decision. And so, but it did. It took a lot of me just saying, hey, I don't know all the answers, but I'll outwork my shortcomings of what I don't know yet until I know it.
No. And what about any particular technical knowledge, expertise? Are there things that somebody coming into Johnson Controls, you know, if they have a background in these topics, that would be really helpful, or they can learn everything on as they go?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I mean, ideally, like what is typically most natural: industrial distribution, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering. Those are the three big ones that come to mind, but man, it doesn't really matter. Like all what I'm normally looking for when I've done interviews now, since being a leader for the last 10 years and interviewing new hire sales folks, it's, do they have the technical aptitude? Like,
yeah.
Do they have the curiosity to want to understand how things work? And if they're not working, why? Right? If like a lot of the time, most of the time now, we have grads come in and do technical presentations, and we pick a topic and we'll be like, hey, we want you to do a presentation on the HVAC refrigeration cycle. Okay. So they'll come in and do the presentation, and you can start asking questions, and you can very quickly understand whether somebody memorized the process or whether their natural inclination was, I want to understand how this works before I go stand up in front of somebody and talk about it. And it's wildly different because you can start asking questions and then they have to process and come up with an answer that they weren't ready for. And you can always tell the people that actually understand, took the time to learn and understand how it worked versus just put a PowerPoint together, understood the talking points, but didn't have the curiosity to really know how it works and not be willing to be done with the presentation until they did. And there's a big difference in those two.
Absolutely. So not necessarily possessing the knowledge, but having the ability and the inclination to go and get it, find it.
Possessing the knowledge is not the most critical part. It's really not to me because there's certain things when I look back now that I was like, man, I wish I would have paid attention in that class a little bit more, but it wouldn't have made that big of a difference. Like, and I'm not saying that academics aren't important. They're very important because it's how you learn, how you teach yourself, how you, and obtain and process knowledge and then put it into real life use is to me what is so critical about higher education, and allows you to be able to do what I'm describing way more effectively because you have a lot of practice doing it over multiple years in college, right? But I'll go like understanding relays and inputs and outputs and all, like, no, like if you have the technical aptitude, it doesn't take long to having an expert sit down and explain that to you that you naturally just pick it up, right? And there's certain times with the refrigeration cycle that I had it fully figured out, totally done, and I was sitting in front of a customer and they would make a comment and then I'm like, oh crap. Maybe I don't know it as well as I do. And I would go back to the drawing board and make sure that I was like thinking through the entire process correctly. So I do think that you do have to have folks that enjoy the technical and have a curiosity for the technical, because part of what makes the sales job so fun is a lot of the time you're calling on other customers and you're account managing other customers that are technical, and then you're selling against other sales engineers who are technical as well. And yeah.
And for, somebody about to start their career, to maybe looking at Johnson Controls, maybe looking at some other places, what would make them an especially good fit for Johnson Controls?
Well, the reason I've been here 18 years is the culture and the people that I've worked alongside of. When I think about, I could go through a lot of the different groups, but my fire installation manager has been here 25 years. My controls installation manager has been here 20. The other has been here 12. My sales manager's been here 12. The other sales manager's been here 5. Like, there's just and I'm not saying that people don't come and go. That happens with anyone. I think that it's important to, and this is somewhat unique in this generation and then just this day and age, someone that's equally as interested in what they're going to give and versus what they're going to get. Right.
Okay.
And somebody, I'll tell you this, somebody that works well in a team environment, because while our owner direct sellers are a little more siloed and on their own, our construction sellers are working in a team environment all day long, right? Because if you think about the example I gave earlier, you may have somebody calling on the owner, somebody calling on the GC, somebody else calling on the MEP consultant, somebody else calling on the mechanical, somebody else calling on the electrical, right? You got all, and we have a mantra of like, we either win together or we lose together, right? So we don't have any lone wolves. The lone wolves that have come through here have not been successful because they don't know how to work in a team environment. And so that one's a big one. I think I kind of hit on some of it. The technical aptitude is obviously very important. I do always ask about competitive. I ask if people played sports. I ask, you know, are they competitive? And then give me examples of where, and you can always tell pretty quick whether somebody's like truly competitive or whether it's just like, yeah, I'm competitive. I don't like like the people that are competitive, like they sit up in their chair and they start talking about it differently. Right. And so, I mean, I don't know that there's any silver bullet. I think really list what we've been talking through this entire time are the key areas. And I think the cool thing about most of those to me is they don't require a lot of talent, right? They don't require some gifted talent, things that you're in control of, your appearance, your communication, you're doing what you say you're going to do, your grit and grind, like all those type of things of like the ability to shut up and listen. Like you may not be a talent to be a listener, but you have the ability to control whether your mouth opens or closes and whether your ears listen or not. Right. And so, you know, I think a lot of it just comes down to understanding the fundamentals, and this could apply to any aspect of life. It can apply to being a husband. It can apply to being a father. It can apply to being a wife, you know, a good friend. It's not really that much different. But it's being able to, even while you're in school, like the way that you show up for labs and the effort that you put forth in a lab compared to the rest of your team is a really great indicator for what you'll do when you're in the workforce. Right. Because you may come into a new job and you're really excited about it and it's great. Okay. But it won't take long before your environment becomes the lab. And it's either you show up and you do your part, or you do heavy lifting because that's what you love to do, or you show up and do the bare minimum and let everybody else do the work. And so I think why higher education and is so critical is because you either take the advantage of learning all of those little minute skills that don't seem like a big deal. But if done correctly and taken advantage of, they impact who you are, not just as a worker in the workforce, but as a human being and as a spouse and a parent and a friend and so many other aspects of life.
Absolutely. Well, that's great. I'm keeping an eye on the time here. That might be a nice place to button sure. things up, but really appreciate your time with us today and eager to see some of your team join us in a couple weeks for the Thai Sales yeah. Showdown.
So. Hey, thank you for the opportunity.
That's it for this interview. I hope you got something valuable out of it. Of course, if you did, be sure to subscribe and rate this podcast on whatever app you use to listen. Also, share this with your colleagues and friends, and let's continue to have a deeper discussion on all things related to selling and sales leadership. See you next time in the Sales Lab.